Okay, so Exodus chapter 17. It's one of those stories that either you know very, very well and quite easily switch off about now thinking, well, that's what he's going to go and say. Or maybe you haven't heard it at all. So when I preached on something similar, a member of our congregation came up to me and she said, I'm really wondering to know what you're going to say about this one. Well, that's good because I knew she was going to listen. So we could go one way or another today. We shall see. I was chatting to some pastors the other week and they asked me how my week was going. So I said I was preparing on Exodus 17. And they said, oh, what are you going to say? I said, well, I've got three little points, three little questions. Do I test God? Do I trust God? And do I see the triumph of God? And he said, Roger, they're not small. I said, but they're only short little words. And what he meant by those is they got massive implications in our lives. So that's where we're going today. Do I test God? Do I trust God? And do I see the triumph of God? And if you want to put in brackets, in my life. So, and what we find with these three questions is they could stand on their own. We could spend the whole of tonight just looking at one of those questions. But if we did that, we wouldn't understand the whole passage. We wouldn't see them build on each other. And these three questions, they do build on each other as we go. So let's think about Exodus for a second. You're jumping into the middle of Exodus. And we know from the beginning of Exodus, don't we, is that God has brought Moses up. And he's told Moses, he's asked Moses to be in charge of his people, the Israelites. And Moses has taken them out of Pharaoh's hands, out of slavery in Egypt, and has led them through the desert, over the sea. And now we find ourselves stuck bang in the middle of the desert. And since their escape from Pharaoh, we've found that God has given them food that they need in chapter 16. If you went back to chapter 15, we find that he's given them water to drink. And he hasn't left them in the middle of the desert to wander around trying to work out where to go. He's given them the cloud during the day and the pillar of fire during the night. And we could just pause for a second on this cloud. And this is a great picture if you know Revelation at all. This is God's glory cloud here in Exodus. We've got God in Revelation, or Christ coming in the cloud. And as we look into that cloud through Isaiah, we find there's angels in that cloud, and there's fire, and there's thunder, and there's noise, and there's creatures, and there is God. And it's God's presence in the middle of this cloud. And here is God leading the Israelites. He's there in his fullness, in his holiness, in his glory, leading them. Isn't that a picture? It's probably something they didn't completely get at that point, but that's the picture that's standing in front of them. And so God, he has led them. He's taken them out of slavery. He's taken them across the sea, hasn't he? He's taken them through the desert. He's made water clean for them to drink. He's given them food. He's provided food for them. And we're at this point, and we've got to say that God, even though he didn't need to at any point, he didn't need to do this, but he's proven to the Israelites that he's completely trustworthy. Whatever they needed, he has provided. He's provided a way for them to escape. He's provided that fresh water 15. He's provided that food in chapter 16. He's provided them sat-nav, tom-tom, your map, a way through the desert. So up until this point, before we get to chapter 17, it's not like Israel hasn't seen God at work. It's not like they haven't had any reason not to trust God. God hasn't let them down at any point so far. And now we get to Exodus chapter 17 and verses 1 to 3. And here we need to start to ask the question to ourselves, do I test God? That's a big question to ask ourselves, but let's be honest. Do I test God? So verse 1, like we've seen previously in Exodus, God is leading them again. He's using the pillars of cloud and fire, and they are following him out of the desert of Sin, where they first received that manna from God. And he's leading them now through the desert to Rodelphingham. And when they arrived at this town, or in this desert, they set up camp, and there was a slight problem. See, I call it a slight problem. In their minds, it was a major problem. The place where they have stopped, where God has led them to, wasn't the way they wanted. Nor is it the way they were expecting. There was no water to drink. So verse 2, what do they do about it? They go to Moses. But in the previous chapters, when there's been something they haven't quite liked, they've grumbled, they've moaned to Moses. Well, now in verse 2, they go a stage further. In fact, what they start to do is quarrel with Moses. That's how the NIV puts it. But in the Hebrew, if we went back to the Hebrew, what it meant was that they were shouting at Moses. It was like a shouting match. I took our young people bowling to Trocadero, and they decided they wanted to go and do something different at the end, and I said, no, we've got to go. And so they did this silent protest on the top of the escalators and said, well, we're not going to move. I said, fine. So I went down the escalators and walked off, and Anna followed, and eventually they followed with me. This wasn't a silent protest. This was an all-out shouting match at Moses. And it could have gone something a bit like this. Give us some water to drink. We have no water. We want water. In fact, we need water. Why haven't you sorted out water for us? Why have you brought us here? There's no water. See, they were coming at this problem with a very self-centered attitude. They decided that this place where God had put them wasn't what they wanted, wasn't what they were expecting. It lacked in water, and so they decided to blame Moses for it. So look at that in verse 7. They say, is the Lord not among us? Or is the Lord among us or not? What they meant by that was, produce the water to prove you are their God. They're questioning, they're saying, God, are you here? Are you with us? We've got no water. And Moses says in reply, look at that in verse 2, why do you shout at me? Why do you quarrel at me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? You could imagine Moses doing a little speech maybe that goes something a bit like this. Look, God has provided everything we've ever needed, hasn't he? He provided a way for us to escape. He provided fresh water and food in the desert. He's provided direction through the desert. What makes now any different? Haven't you learnt yet, Israel, that when we need something, God always provides it? See, by shouting at me, Moses, for water, is just testing God to see if he is with us and will provide it. Just wait. God has been with us so far. He knows we need water, and he will give us what we need when we need it. So verse 3, maybe that isn't exactly what Moses said, But it gives you a sense of what's going on. Here's Israel shouting, and here's Moses saying, look, God will provide. All you're doing is testing him. But that little speech, it didn't make any difference. You see, they were so self-centered in their attitude, so convinced that they should have water now, they shouted all the more at him. And this little shouting that we see in verse 3, the way the NRA puts it doesn't really help us that much. It's made it plural. So why do you bring us out of Egypt? To make us and our children, our livestock, die of thirst. It sounds like the whole community is shouting. But in fact, the Hebrew makes it all about the me, about I. So what they were shouting to Moses was, why did you bring me up out of Egypt? Why did you make me and my children and livestock die of thirst? The whole community were only worried about themselves and what they wanted. Do you get the point? It's all about the me as far as Israel are concerned. And the result of that is that they're effectively, Moses says, testing God. So let's just pause, take a break in the story for a second, and ask that poignant question. Do you test God in the same way? Now clearly, you're not stuck in a desert without water. I understand that much. But you are, like Israel, a follower of God. You are one of his people. You've done what God has asked, haven't you? You've given your life to him. You are serving him. You've been following him like all good disciples should. Your faith has in fact been growing. But, and I'm sure you've come across this, if you're honest in your heart, I know I personally have. Life isn't as you expected as a Christian, maybe. Life as a Christian isn't what you thought it would be. Things are still hard. You're still missing out on what you think is important. You're still suffering in different ways. Or how do we deal with this? See, do you come to God with this self-centered attitude, shouting at God like Israel did, demanding off of God what you think you should have, complaining to God that in fact he still hasn't given it to you yet? Do you go to God like that? Well, you see, if you do, Moses tells you all you're doing is testing God. You're trying to see if God is there. You see, there's this massive difference between demanding and shouting, complaining to God with this self-centered attitude, testing God to see if he's there. See, there's a difference with that to the way Moses behaves, the way Moses reacts. He trusts God instead. So let's move on to that trusting. Do I trust God? And in brackets, like Moses will do, as we see in a minute. So verses 4-7. You see, clearly Israel was in no mood to listen to Moses. It's a bit like a child when they've decided they want something and you as a parent says no. Sometimes there's just no way to get through to them. You just have to stick them on the step and not listen to them until they've chilled out a bit. Well, this is what's going on here, but much, much worse. The situation has got so bad that Moses is now in fear of his life. So there is Moses. Can you imagine? Maybe stood on his rock in front of the community, being shouted at, the community really angry at him. And he says to God, what am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me. See, clearly Moses is trusting God in this situation. He doesn't ask for water. Do you notice that? He hasn't gone to God and said, God, give us some water. See, wouldn't that solve the problem? It would make the community happy. He needs water just as much as everybody else. But no, he doesn't ask for that. Rather, he says to God, well, how should I deal with these angry people? You see, because deep down, Moses knows something that the Israelites still haven't got. He knows deep down that God will supply the water when they need it. You see, getting the water is not the issue for Moses. The issue for him is they're about to stone him. And so he asks God to solve that problem. And verses 5 to 6, God is gracious. He gives them what they really don't deserve. They haven't trusted him, and yet God is gracious. And he tells Moses, right, once again, Moses, you're going to have to lead the people. Go out in front of the people, in verse 5, and take some elders with you. They need to be your witnesses that me, God, again, will be providing the water. And take that staff, Moses, you know, the one that you've used already in Egypt to perform miracles. Take that with you. And God says, Moses, go to this rock and strike the rock with your staff. And there I will be, Moses. I will be on that rock and I will produce the water. And that's what Moses did. Following God's command, trusting in God completely, struck the rock and the water flowed. The people didn't deserve that water, did they? All they did was test God, yet God in his grace produced it. And so Moses, in verse 7, he names that area Test and Quarrel. Massa and Meribah, that's what it means. Because that is what Israel were doing. They were testing God. They were quarreling with Moses. You see, Moses was in the same position as the Israelites. He was without water. But he's not reacting in the same way. Deep down in his heart, he trusts God. He has a real deep sense of trust. He knows how God has provided in the past. And he knows that God will provide in the future. He hasn't complained. He knows that wait and God will provide. So let's come back to us again. Do you test God? I'm in this situation, maybe you say, where life isn't how I wanted. It hasn't gone the way I planned. I've done all of this. I've followed God and I'm still suffering. Maybe in that you can start to hear that self-centered attitude coming out. Well, let me just say in return, has Christ not saved you? Has God not brought you this far? Has he not allowed you to be in this situation? Has God not given you all you need through his Holy Spirit up until this point? And in one sense, those questions don't need answering because you know them already. Of course Christ has saved you. Of course he has brought you this far. And you know he has allowed this situation for 1,000 different reasons, but you are in it. And you know you have the Holy Spirit to help you because he has been helping you up until this point. So simply, trust God. See, where you find yourself in at this moment, the situation you're in, might not be what you had in mind when you first started following God. But do you think God doesn't know your situation? Of course not. Do you think that it's beyond him? Moses hitting rock and getting God producing rock out of water is not beyond him. Our situation can't be beyond him. God is always with you. He has given you his spirit. So don't shout at God. Don't demand off of God. Don't test God to see if he's there with you. But rather, ask for what you need. God says if you ask, you'll receive it. There's that big difference between asking and shouting. Between going to God with a sincere heart and demanding of God what you think you should have. It would have been very, very different if Israel had gone to God with a sincere heart, truly in prayer. It would have been a very different story. But they didn't. And don't complain about your situation. Rather, just be honest with God. Tell him how you're struggling. We do all struggle. We're not superhumans. That's not a problem. God knows that. But look to God to help you. This, again, is very different to moaning and complaining to God. Not actually wanting help. So do I test God? Well, if you do, you need to trust him. And if you don't test God, that's great, that's wonderful. But do you trust God in the depths that Moses trusted God? He didn't need to ask for water. He knew it would come. Do you trust God deep down to provide? And now we move on to the second part, this other little part in chapter 17, which is probably more of a famous story, verses 8 to 16. In all of Israel's grumbling and moaning, in all their lack of trust towards Moses, and therefore lack of trust towards God, or in all this self-centered attitude, it has become, for Israel, a very dangerous position to be in. You see, it's resulted for them in them thinking that the enemy is inside the community. In this case, they think it is Moses. They try to kill him. They see him as the enemy. When in fact, they're just about to find out in this little story that the enemy is on the outside. And that is who they should be worried about. So verse 8, the Amalekites, and these are a set of people that live in the desert, they start to attack Israel. And this is the first time that Israel have been attacked since they left Egypt. And now they're in a position where their eyes have been opened up. Actually, they realise there's an enemy on the outside they should be worried about. This is who they should be fighting. The Canaanites, not Moses. See, all Moses ever wanted was their freedom. He wanted good for that community. And they're now starting to realise it. So in verse 9... we need to remember that because God has called Moses, Moses speaks on behalf of God. When Moses speaks, God is effectively speaking. And so now God commands a different approach with this enemy. In the past, in Egypt, God's approach has been one of plagues, hasn't it? But now, God calls for a battle. This is a new way to deal with an enemy. So Moses, and so God, tells Joshua to gather an army together and that tomorrow he'll be up on the hill with his staff of God. And as we get to verse 10, the Israelites seem to have had a change in heart since the water incident. They seem to have now learned to trust Moses, and so they're trusting God. Because Joshua did as Moses said. He got the army together. And they did as they were told. They went and fought the Amalekites. And Moses was where he said he would be. He was up with his staff on the hill. Now we know when anyone goes up on a hillside in the Old Testament, they're not up there on their own, are they? Okay, Moses has got his two friends with him, Aaron and Hur, but they're not on their own. They're up there with God. When someone goes up a mountain, they're going to meet with God. And so God is there with them on this hillside. You've got the battlefield in front of you, Moses, Aaron, Hur, and God up on the hill. And that's important to remember. So we get to verses 11 to 13. And it's God who works in this battle. It's God who wins over the Amalekites, not the Israelites. You see, this battle is not going to be won by Israel. See, that's just not going to happen. They're not a fully formed army yet. This is their first battle in one sense. They've had no real training. They only got picked 12 hours ago, the night before. Some of them maybe have never even used a sword. But rather, God is going to win the battle for them. You see, it's God's power that's going to win and not theirs. And this is why the story now is all about the mountainside and not the battlefield. I don't know if you like Lord of the Rings at all, Tolkien. If you watch the films, read the books, the battle story is all about what's going on the battlefield, isn't it? It's about which company comes in from which angle. It's about who turns up at what time. It's about which enemy is doing different things. The story is always focused on the battlefield. But the story here is up on the hillside. The battle is forgotten about in one sense. And the writer is writing about what's going on up here. And that's a clue to us to what is really happening. The writer wants us to pick up on God doing the work and not Israel. And the story's a bit odd. As long as Moses keeps his hands up, they win the battle. The moment Moses drops his hands, they start to lose. And this is the writer showing us how God has paired his power along with Moses. It's a bit like when Moses hit the rock with his staff and the water came out. That wasn't Moses doing a magic trick and hitting the rock and water appearing because of his staff. That was God pairing his power with Moses' stick and producing water. And it's the same that's going on here. As long as Moses' arms are up, God is pairing his power with Moses and they're winning the battle. Why has God chosen to do it that way? Well, that's for us to ask another stage. God works in mysterious ways, and this is just another one. And so it resulted in verse 13, Joshua overcoming the army with the sword. Because Moses has trusted God, because in this situation Israel is trusting God, God has triumphed over their enemies. Because they've stopped testing God, because they're now trusting him, they have watched and they have seen God win in their battle. He has won for them. But God goes further in verse 14 and he makes a promise to Joshua and the whole of Israel that eventually he will destroy the Amalekites. Look at that in verse 16. The war might go on for generation to generation in verse 16. But in verse 14, God does say, I will completely blot out the name of them under heaven. And it's not until David's time do we see God fulfill that promise. But he does. In 1 Samuel, God fulfills that promise. Once again, proving, not that he needs to, that God is trustworthy. So do I see the triumph of God in my life? We need to note very quickly that the enemy shouldn't be and should never be within our church. It's so painful to see, and I've personally gone through it, when a church splits. That they get inward looking, they start to argue between themselves, and before you know it, they've split off in different directions. That's painful. That's not the way it should be. The enemy should never be within the church. When that happens, what tends to happen is the church, the Christians, have forgotten their purpose, why God has saved them. They've forgotten that God has saved them to glorify him. They've forgotten that God has saved them to spread his word. And they've got inward looking. And they've created a problem that probably didn't exist in the first place. And have split. That isn't where our enemy should be. Our enemy, nor should I say, an enemy isn't a person that causes us trouble. Now this is really important. An enemy is a person, isn't a person who causes us trouble. You see, this would be wonderful to think this. It would be wonderful to think that our enemy is the boss that is always nasty to us. It would be wonderful to think that the enemy is our neighbour who is always making noises and mess and keeping us up at night. Why? Because according to this passage, God would defeat that enemy. Or it would be great to think maybe the utility companies that are always overcharging us and getting our bills wrong is our enemy. Or that the work colleague that's always stabbing us in the back, trying to get the next promotion over us, is our enemy. Again, why? Because this passage would say that God will defeat that person. If we trust him, God will flatten them to the ground. It'd be great to think that, wouldn't it? Make our lives so much easier. But that is not, they are not our enemies. The real enemy is not in the church, shouldn't be. It's not the person that makes life harder. The real enemy is someone much, much bigger. See, the situation Israel found themselves in was life or death. It could have gone one way or the other. Either they get killed by the Amalekites, or God will save them. The real enemy is the person who threatens to take the lives of God's people. You see, God's first concern is our spiritual life. That is the most important life there is, our spiritual well-being. That is why he sacrificed his son, for no other reason than to save us spiritually. So we can have a new spiritual life with God. That's God's first concern. The real enemy then are those who can seriously affect our spiritual state. It's the friendships that we might keep, that maybe they've turned slightly unwholesome and affect how we stand with God. It's maybe the fear of the future Like the Israelites didn't trust God, we don't trust God fully for all our needs. It's maybe the words we use with our spouses and our children. Giving them showing them how self-centered maybe we've become. Maybe it's our avoidance of prayer. Not wanting to be bothered to talk to God. Not wanting to spend time with God. Forgetting, just letting time disappear. Forgetting God completely. Do you see, it's the corruptions of the simple pleasures that God has given us. So there's nothing wrong with friendships. We need good friendships to spread God's gospel. But when they turn unwholesome and they affect how we stand with God, that's when it's a problem. And that is the real enemy. It's the devil who corrupts what God has given us that is good. You see, he's sly, the devil. He subtly corrupts what is good. And so before we know it, we're dying spiritually. I remember I had a great friendship with a guy of mine, a friend of mine in the youth group. Really, really good guy. We used to pray together. Good friendship. He got a non-Christian girlfriend and slowly started, stopped going to church, stopped praying. And I kept that friendship with him. There's nothing wrong with that. But that friendship then got corrupted. And I stopped going to church. I stopped praying. I stopped following God. There's nothing wrong with a friendship. But when the devil corrupts it, it is. That's the enemy, the devil. And this is why Moses calls that place where they had that war, the Lord is my banner. It means a call to arms. God has called me to arms. God has called me into battle. That doesn't mean I'm saying go out and fight. I'm not saying that. But it's a spiritual fight. God is calling us to a spiritual fight. This is why Paul tells us in the New Testament to put on the armour of God. It's to be ready for the battle. It's to be ready to battle the devil and his subtle corruptions. So do we see God triumph in our lives? Can we identify areas where the devil has subtly corrupted things that were good but are now taking us away from God? Have you asked God to defeat them? Are you trusting God to defeat them? God can and he will triumph against them. See, Christ has already beaten the devil. We see that in Revelation. We see that the devil is already crushed. And he did that by rising again. He's proven that he is powerful enough by rising again. The war has been won. And we need to believe that. We need to know that. God is powerful and works for us. Don't test him, but trust him and ask him to triumph in areas that you know have been corrupted, in areas where you know you're dying spiritually.